I mean, after the class, the previous class, someone came and asked me a few questions about the notation, and I think let me just spend a few minutes reminding, refreshing your mind, or if not, clarifying some doubts on that. So let's just go way back and think you are in, let's see, remember when you were in three dimensions, let's say in the Euclidean case, it was very convenient, say, if you were using Cartesian coordinate system to have the basis given by the I hat vector, J hat vector, K hat vector. So these were unit vectors that were normal, orthogonal to each other, and they span the 3D space. And so a vector could be represented by simply, say, the components with commas, or just the components along each one of these suitable unit vectors. And so if you imagine introducing this notation, E supra A, and I'm putting on purpose the supra A because I'm beginning to make contact with the way we're noting things, to say each member of the basis of this family that will, there is a basis and span our space, I'm going to label it with I. So I equal 1 gives us I hat, 2 equal J hat, 3 equal K hat, but each one of them is a vector, so I'm being completely rigorous here, so I want to have that A. So A here, denote that each component is a vector, and this one is simply labeling the members of the family. And so here we can then redo this and express it this way. Of course, repeated indices, we know there are some, and I'm being very verbose here and putting that under bar there just to remind us that we have to sum them up. And these are components, they are not vectors. The vector character of this object is denoted by the A in here. So what we're doing is just expanding on that. And so for instance, when we have the vector, we're saying that's a vector. We denote it as an kind of as an entity on its own. It's a member, it's one member of the TP space, the tangent space at the point P. And this is abstract. So it could be a vector, but we haven't made no reference whatsoever on the particular coordinates that we're choosing to represent that vector. So suppose we take, we know how to have a chart, we go into Rn, and we have our coordinates x. So then we saw that the way to represent that vector in terms of components and in this coordinate basis is like this. And here I'm using alpha, so sorry, I'm using a Greek letter, to denote now components. So this is, these are not the vectors. The vector is given by that. This one is each individual component of the vector v in the coordinate basis x. And this index, the index alpha is supposed to run or be sum over every single component that we have in our space, our manifold. And again, this A is denoting the fact that each one of those is a bona fide vector represented in that chart in those coordinates. And this is dx, dy, dz, which would, if we were linking with this, it would be ijk. But okay, we know that we can choose any coordinate system that we want. So in the coordinate system x, we could have written, we would have written this way. In coordinate system y, we would have written this way, where I'm now putting little here on top of v, just, you know, these are different values. This, the components will be different, and of course will be different, and the directions will be different because we could have chosen a y coordinate system that is kind of rotated. It's now a different coordinate system or whatever we want to choose. But the vector is still the vector. So this va is still this va. We are just choosing to represent it this way or that way. So out of just that, we can say, well, these two things better be equal. So this is true. The sum of components along x of the vector denoted with A will have to be the same as the sum, sorry, this is beta A. And just by this observation, which we're going to do over and over, depending on particular opportunities that we're going to have to kind of equate things, then you can derive the transformation law for the components of a vector as you change your coordinate system. And for that, you simply remember that associated to our vector, I'm going to put an A and an A up and down, associated with a vector, it was a dual space, dp star, that took a, take a vector and takes and gives us a real. So in combination, if we have a vector, now we use the word contracting. Remember, the metric gives us a way to do inner products. So this acting on the same coordinates will simply give us a delta gamma beta. So only when we take the displacement in the same direction of our gradient, we will have a 1. Otherwise, we'll have a 0. So it's, we're choosing a coordinate basis. But if that's true, then we can use this one in this line. So I can imagine fitting to this equation on the right dy gamma, this denoting one component of the dual vector space by A. Using our notation, we're seeing the A now, it's going to be contracted with an A that is down, downstairs. And as we proceed through, so this one acting on that one will give us a delta because of that. But this one being acted upon this will give us whatever it is. It's a derivative. So this will turn into d alpha, the component of dy gamma with respect to dx alpha. And here we have the delta on the right-hand side, which will pick a single component in the twiddle or in the y-coordinate system. And so then we arrive at this, which was our law of transformation for a vector. This is the component of the vector v, when represented in terms of the coordinates y, are given by this combination of components of the vector v when represented in coordinates x times the suitable Jacobian. And of course, here there is an addition. So alpha and alpha are repeated, so we have to run through that. So this is the way we use the abstract in the notation. We abuse about it a little bit. So whenever we see the quantity just by itself, we say, oh, this is a tensor or a vector or a covector, whatever. In a yet to be determined coordinate system, we've specified if we don't need it, we're going to keep carrying it through till we may need to introduce a particular representation with respect to a coordinate system. But if not, then we just carry it through. And one thing we have to be very careful is to make sure that we have the index in the right place. It is a supraindex, because that's a vector. But a subindex is a covector. And same thing with an arbitrary component. So we have to be very careful not to write things of this form. Right? That doesn't make sense, because it's neither a contraction, so it's not a map from TP or TP dual into the reals. We really don't know what it is. So this, we might have been trying to do this, the contraction, or we might have been trying to construct this object. So this is a real, and this is a 2-0 tensor. Right? So if there is something you have to be very, very careful with using this notation, is where you put the indices. This object, sorry, you can put a B. This object is extreme, it's totally different from that object. And this one is very likely a typo, so be careful what is it that you wanted to do. So as an exercise, I'm leaving you to use that kind of argument. And remember, if we had that, so we have this duality between TP, the tangent vector space, and the cotangent vector space, and we can go back and forth. So if this is true, that is true. So where you're acting with kind of differential along y on the gradient, you're going to get a delta, or the gradient actor and differential, we get a delta. It's just the same relation. So use this to derive the transformation law of components of a covector. Yes, go ahead.
I'm struggling to see why that's a delta and not, if it was a general metric, would it be the metric?
This one? No. So we are choosing a coordinate basis. So that's why you have a delta.
For a general basis, it would be something else.
If you have chosen a different set of coordinates, yes. So this dot product might give you something else. But here is, you have chosen a coordinate basis to represent your vector and your covectors, and associated to it, the dual will satisfy.
Sorry.
Remember, and this operation is taking place on Rn, not in the manifold. We have done the mapping to Rn, and in Rn, then we can do the standard calculations that we would know.
Sorry, I must have missed something. Where did we get that delta equation?
This one? So this one, remember, we define the dual space TP, let's say TP dual, was something, this was a map W that take two vectors into the real. And in particular, we, if you want, with the metric, we were able to define that inner product in a standard, in a suitable way. So here we're saying this is an element of the dual. This is an element of the dual to TP. This is an element of TP represented in terms of our mapping to Rn. And this is just a gradient along y of a displacement in y, but along the x, the gamma direction. This, the gradient along the beta direction in y. And so this is why we get a delta, because otherwise we just are moving in the orthogonal direction. So do a simple exercise. Try obtaining the same kind of the analog rule for the transformation of components of a covector. One thing, another kind of little mnemonics, it's just a little mnemonics to keep in mind. Remember I said be very careful to keep track of where the indices are. So whenever you see now in components ddy, you can interpret it. So if the y, so if this index that is in the denominator has the index on the supra index position, this would be kind of interpreted as having the differential in the lower position. Just keep that in mind. That is also, when you do calculations, it's a good way to keep track that what you're doing is making sense. The other thing I was going to say, so usually every day, every class, I'm here at least half an hour before we start. So if you have questions, that's another opportunity. You can come, bring your breakfast, and we can also chat. I have another exercise that I want you to go through. Again, these are all simple exercises, but that have some interesting application of things that we've been discussing. So remember, we said that the Christoffel symbols are given by this. And as once we write Christoffel symbols, this C is here put following a question the other day. It's either at the end or first. It doesn't matter where it is, but make sure that if once you pick a convention, stick to it. So this one was our expression. So how do we prove it? So, well, one, you can prove it rather straightforwardly. But remember that the covariant derivative, so of acting on the metric, gives us zero, right? So that's how we define our unique derivative operator, covariant derivative operator. So you can do this is true, but you can now interpret G as a tensor. It's a tensor, it's a 0-2 tensor, and we know how to derive the covariant derivatives of 0-2 tensors. Right? It's just the extension of what we had before. So maybe let me just write it here. So remember that for a 0-1 tensor or a covector, we had the grad A of BB. The A, B, minus gamma A, B, C, B, C. And again, this is something that I suggest you remember, because you're going to be using this operation over and over. But if you now have a vector of the covariant derivative of vector B, C, then it's D, A, B, B, C, minus gamma A, B, B, sorry. A, B, C, D. I want to respect the order. Right. So notice what happened here. So the first is just a direct partial derivative of that. And then we have a Christoffel symbol. The indices have to match. So I have A, B, C free. And so I have A, B. I replace one of them. Well, let me just, before I go there, let's see what happened here. So the indices A, B are respected by the Christoffel. And then we're adding through the components of B, C. And now we have an object that has two indices. We have to run through each one of them because we have to correct the failure of this derivative to produce something that is a bona fide tensor. So we have a correction for going along this direction and a correction for going along this other direction. So again, this is A, B. So we're going to run over that index. So AB, and then the summation here is through the free component of the Christoffel and the component that we're trying to correct. The R1C stays put because we haven't touched that one yet. And then we have one for that one. If, remember the same trick that we did before, if you don't believe that, you can prove it yourself, because you do know this, and you do know the transformation of a scatter. So you can contract a scatter by a suitable contraction of BBC with a vector. So you can use the transformation, the derivative operator of the covariant derivative in a vector, the covariant derivative of a covector, and out of that, describe the covariant derivative of a scalar, and out of that, you can construct this one. So then you can use, now each one of these, notice the only thing I'm doing is just cycling over ABC, so this ABC, BCA, CAB. Also use that the metric, or this tensor here, is symmetric. And because we're in a torsion-free case, the Christoffel symbols are also symmetric. So expand each one of these using your rule for the covariant derivative. And I'll take any one and subtract the R2. And multiply by a suitable inverse metric with the right components. And the right components will depend on which one you're subtracting, where you're taking these and subtracting the R2, or whichever one you choose. And out of that, you're going to be able to prove that. So give it a try. It's done through in the books. And if you have any questions, also ask me. But that's a good exercise to kind of start massaging indices. Any questions? So what we're going to do today is try and derive kind of the final key ingredient that we need. And that's will be the Riemann tensor. So remember, that because we're thinking that we're dealing with a curved space, parallel transports of tensor, of vectors, or tensor in general, as we go around the loop, will not give us back the same object that we started with. It will be rotated with respect to the one we started with, and that will be measured by this tensor. So what we could do is imagine you have two vectors, vector AA, vector BA. We're going to do, let's say, this trajectory and come back. And we're trying to ask the question is, if we go, say, in this direction, how does the vector, a vector, let's say, B rho, changes as we go around? So just as before, if we say, well, what would be the change? I mean, just to kind of motivate what we think we're going to get, just as we did in the past, we say, well, the vector as it changes will depend on the vector itself, the path it takes, or the path it takes will depend on the vectors A and B, which are the vectors that we're using to define the path. And so, of course, here we're going along A. So we go here, we go along B, let's say B parallel transported here. Then we come here, and we're going against A. And we come down, and we're going against B. So this will have some consequence. So we expect that this thing will change, and we'll have, I need something here. Let me call it S for something. It will depend on B, so our vector, let me call it B sigma, our vector A, and our vector B nu. So we need an object here, and it produces a vector that will have free index rho. So at least I will have one, two, three legs, plus a fourth leg, which should be the one that will give us the character of the vector. So then let me call it rho sigma nu. The other thing we would note right away is that, okay, if we do this turn, we will get something. But if we chose to go in the opposite direction, we would get the opposite sign. So right, if this going this way will give us this change, we start with this one, and we go in the opposite direction, will give us the opposite change. So this tells us that this whatever object we have in here will be such that these things along in these two indices will be anti-symmetric. So this S thing in here, if I flip the orders of U and nu, I should get a minus sign. Okay, then rather than using S, let's call it R. And that would be our Riemann tensor.
Quick question.
Yes.
Did we last time have like an equation for like parallel transport, and is this where it comes?
Yes.
From? What was that equation?
Oh, what was that equation? We would say if you have a vector, a vector VA, the parallel transport along VA would be grad A of your vector. That would be a way to parallel transport along this VA.
Oh, how's that related?
Yes. Okay, so good question. We can do that. We can say, okay, parallel transport along A, parallel transport along B, go all the way, and then you're going to get that expression, and you're going to find from here this. But there is an easier way to get it, and that's the one we're going to discuss next, which is consider.
Can I ask?
Yes.
Sorry. Could you say again why we need, so I understand why it depends on the vector itself.
Right.
Because of the map, but why do we need two vectors, A and B? To specify
Well, we're imagining just a small loop, and then we're that this loop we're going to approximate it by just going around, say, a parallelepipedal, or which will be given by this. And for simplicity, I'm going to use two vectors for that.
Okay.
So the simpler way of getting what this Riemann is, because we still haven't said what this is to consider the following operation. Consider the covariant derivative along these two directions, nu and mu, that you were defining this way, the commutator of that on the vector v rho. Why? It's because this will be kind of analogous to what's going to happen here. You parallel transport along one, the result you parallel transport along the R1, and you're comparing with doing it this way and that way. So you essentially we're comparing what happens when we go here. If we go one, two, one, two, the order gets flipped, and this is what this covariant derivative is doing. Right, this will give us grad mu of grad nu of the vector v rho minus grad mu of the vector v rho. And here, okay, these are computations, things that we already know. You don't have to say, okay, that's a vector. When I operate with the covariant derivative mu, that produces for us a tensor, which is 1, 1. Right, we have one index down, one index up. Then we're going to take a covariant derivative of that. That will give us a 2, 1. So go through this, go through that one, use our expressions for the covariant derivative operators, and then you'll get that this implies the following. So this object in here will be given by this definition, which again, you can find by this. So for instance, when you do this computation, you know you're going to have a derivative, a partial derivative of the nu and a Christoffel. Once you act with this, you're going to pick up derivatives of the Christoffel. This is what gives us these pieces. And product of Christoffels, which is what happens here. Yes.
Wait, sorry. So the commutator of the two covariant derivatives, what's the exact relation between that and like the Riemann tensor.
Yes, good. This is.
Okay.
That. So out of that, we arrive to this expression, which is interesting because, again, it's made up, or we're writing it in terms of things that we know are not tensors. But we're saying the result is a tensor. Yes?
Instead of taking the commutator of covariant derivative, should we not take VA covariant VA and the commutator of that?
So that's what you would do if you do the calculation this way. But you can also analogously motivate it that this is, will give you the same thing.
This is not parallel transport, right? Because it's just a covariant derivative.
Right. But in essence, this is what you're doing. So the covariant derivative, the parallel transport will pick up coefficients of A and B as you're doing the parallel transport of that. And you can do the calculation. You see that this would be analogous to that because the key information is in this piece, in the covariant derivatives when they're acting. Then it's going to be proportional to A and B, or general A's and B's that you could choose it, you could have chosen, and then you show that you can throw them away.
We should also expect commutator of A and B if we do it that way. So we'll get some extra term.
No, you're going to see they can be discarded because they're for general A and B, and then you can see that this is the only effect that you end up with in the end. I mean, this ends up just giving you that. Yes. Yes.
Do the covariant derivative of Christopher
symbol,
how does it work?
You just take the derivative, the partial derivative. So it's a symbol. You just carry through the derivative. And you're going to see because of the symmetric properties, the symmetries of the Christoffel symbol, most of it will get thrown away. And you just have this as an end result. Yes.
Just a note, the row index should maybe go close to the R instead of R. Just, no, in the, I think that one is correct, the one above.
The commutator formula.
The commutator formula. Otherwise, the.
Yeah, sorry. Thank you. Okay, this is an object, and we're going to try and compute some explicit example. But that's the object that we're going to use to build our theory. But before we go there, we want to say a few things about its properties. Yes?
Sorry. The indices in the Riemann tensor expression have to be, in the first, the row that's below have to be a sigma.
Oh, don't tell me all you.
Terms.
Which one?
The first term. Because we have to have rho sigma min mi.
Mu, rho, osh. Yes.
Yes.
Oh, no. Wow. Sigma. Mu, this one is fine.
But the other
one. Mu lambda v sigma. Yes, thank you. Sorry, I have a problem with Greek letters. Yeah. Yeah. To me, psi and phi, they're all the same. Very quickly. Sorry. I know, but when I start writing them, they become the same thing very quickly. That's why I typically avoid Greek letters. Okay, so in fact, I'm going to do that right now. So what are the properties of RAB? So remember, so as written this way, okay, what is the type of tensor we're dealing with? 1, 3, right? We have 3 covariant indices, 1 contravariant index or supra-index. But we can use the metric to go back and forth between any of them. So let's lower the row and work with all the indices down for the moment. So some properties, key properties. RABCD is equal to minus RBACD. So anti-symmetric in the first two indices. anti-symmetric in the last two indices. We already argue why these are. Symmetric on pair commutation. So let me A, B, C, D. So this is true. So if I flip this one to the other side, I get the same object. And finally, well, not finally, there's a few more. We also have R, A, no, oh, I can do this. Do you know what this notation is? Sorry, this anti-symmetric, okay. So, okay, with an object that has this many symmetries, we're going to introduce a few more as we go along. We will want to know how many free components we have. So we'll have to determine that object, how many components we need to worry about. So we can do the calculation. And this may is one of the things that every now and then shows up in a qualifier examination. So let's go through it. So if I just think of it, let's start with the first component. So we have an object that is anti-symmetric in the first two indices, anti-symmetric in the last two indices, and symmetric over this pair. If I think of this as a single index, it's symmetric upon this exchange, right? Anti-symmetric. So for all we care about is if we think of we have a matrix M with indices A and B, if it is anti-symmetric and we have M components, if the number of components that are non-trivial is M plus 1 divided by 2. So if we have n components in A, n components in B, if this is a square matrix, we have n times n minus 1 divided by 2 free components. If I have another matrix, let's call it n, you know, C of D.
Symmetric in A and B?
This is anti. And this is sim. So if we have now a symmetric matrix with m components, this will be m plus 1 divided by 2. These are the number of free components. So we can use this result and that result to argue that the total number of non-trivial components using these three properties will be given by 1 half n minus 1 divided by 2 times n minus 1 divided by 2 plus 1. We still have to use this R one. We have not used this one. And from this and the previous one, you could also say this is true. I just moved the antisymmetric all the way to the first one. And then you can ask, how many conditions we have out of this? How many things are supposed to be zero? Once I do this, all the accounting for the number of permutations I can be allowed for that. And this is, we'll say, there are n minus 1, n minus 2, times n minus 3, divided by 4 factorial, things that should be equal to 0 out of this condition. Yes?
Sorry, I'm confused how we got the.
OK, so start here.
Yeah.
And you say, I have m times n plus 1 divided by 2, if I just think of this property. But now, remember, I just constructed this. I said A and B, take it as if it were a single index. And if you had n components in there, that would be the m components in there, that would be the result. That would be the result. But then here,
okay.
I need to account for how many components do I have. And those components are this.
OK, nice. Thank you.
Oh, welcome. And then we have to subtract this one. Once you put this minus that, your result is the number of independent components is equal to 1/12 n squared minus 1, where n is the number of dimensions of your manifold.
Sorry, is that 4 factorial or 41?
4 factorial.
That's
yeah, the 41, I mean, 41 is not a number that shows up anywhere. So whenever you get a number that is odd, then that's, you said, okay, something went wrong. Even though the answer is 42, what is the, yeah.
Yeah, the answer to the meaning of life, the universe, and everything. But is this like just simplifying the last line, or where did that?
No, this one came, so we stop here.
Okay.
If this were not true, you would have said this is the total number of free components or independent components I have. But I also need to impose this one, which adds this number of equations to eliminate components. So
why is that? Why does it add that number?
Because we still haven't imposed this one. So one thing you would have out of this one, let's say, is R 1, 2, 3, 4, plus and minus all the combinations have to be equal to 0. And you have to consider every single one of those. And you say, well, how many equations or how many conditions would I derive out of this condition? And this is this one, which means it will reduce the number of independent components by this amount.
Okay.
Yes?
What's the plus one in the second term?
This one?
Yeah.
So this one came from here. You said, remember, we said, suppose you have you're thinking of this object that has 4 indices, but it's symmetric on the pair of indices. So I'm kind of even pictorially calling this whole thing A and this whole thing B. So now take that away and say how many free components I have on an object that has components A and B where it's symmetric. And it has a total of m of those. So we have m times m plus 1 divided by 2. But then we recall that this A came from here, which is A and B. And A had n components because we're in a space that is, or a manifold that is n dimensional. But it's anti-symmetric. So then we have a total of n minus 1 divided by 2 associated to that. So let's just pause for a second. So suppose you have a space-time that is two-dimensional. So n is equal to 2, which means we have 4 times 3 divided by 12, only one independent component. So that means that if you have a sphere that's a two-dimensional object, there's only one piece of information that determines the Riemann tensor. Everything else is just different ways of writing the very same component in different components. If you have three, so three dimensions, then you have a 6 independent components. And n equal 4, okay, these are the dimensions we care about.
I'm sorry.
To do physics in real life, yes.
Did you subtract the last?
Yes, you subtract this. Then n equal 4, you have 20 independent components. And okay, and so on. So if you're in strict theory and you go all the way to dimension whatever 11, you can imagine how many you have. But of course, there one adds perhaps a large degree of symmetry is based on some arguments to deal with something that's more manageable. But in general, you're going to have a horrible mess.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
The first three properties of Riemann tensor, they came directly from the fact that like real parallel transporting
right.
some vector, and it doesn't depend on the metric.
Good. Yes.
One,
as well, by then, by just flipping signs and just playing around and understanding that, well, there are lots of symmetries that we have also built up in the definition that we have to account for.
So independent of any manifold that we have. Any
that's right.
That we have, we
these
have,
are true. Yes. Yeah. And then we still have another symmetry, another equation that we're going to introduce very soon, which are Bianchi identities, which are identities that the derivatives of this object also satisfy. What else I was going to say? So, as because R, or Riemann, is the object that tells us, well, where our space M is curved, the conversely is true. If we happen to have an R that is 0 at all points, all components, then we're going to say the space M is flat. It's going to turn out to be convenient to perhaps think of a decomposition of this object. So suppose take a tensor, a two tensor. It's called a TAB. We may want to write this thing, and depending on the application, we're going to keep coming here and doing different decomposition of this TAB, and you'll see as we go along in some cases. Let me introduce the first one. We might want to write this as TAB trace free. So a piece that if I just compute the trace, how would you compute a trace? So a trace would be G of AB TAB. Why? It's because this A lowers an index. So let's just pick the A. Let's imagine that it's leaving the B free. So the A is added. As a result, it gets replaced by the B. But now these things have to be added up. So this is just a familiar trace. You just take the object and add up the diagonal terms. So you might want to say, well, I want to write TAB as a TAB trace free. So if I took away the trace, I want to give it back because I want to represent this one. So this is the trace. I'm going to write it this way for the time being. So here I got the trace. I got the trace free part. I still have, and the trace free part that is also symmetric. And then I want the trace free part of the anti-symmetric part. OK, but if it is anti-symmetric, there is no trace. So I can take this out. So I can choose to do that. And that will be convenient to write. And we're going to do that with the Riemann tensor.
When you decompose something into its symmetric and anti-symmetric parts, don't you usually have to put like one half in front? Or no, maybe that's not the case.
No. OK, so here we have, I haven't defined what it is. So this one will be one half TAB plus TBA. So then it accounts for it. And if that's a symmetric part,
yeah,
it accounts for that one half. Same thing in the anti-symmetric part, once you flipped, and then we'll simplify that T. So let me go through the Riemann tensor first, and then we're going to come back to being more explicit. So we might want to define out of the four indices that the Riemann tensor have, let's define an associated tensor, which is the Ricci tensor. And this is going to be R AB, R lambda A lambda B. So what we're doing is contracting this index. If you want, I can write it this way. And I'm being verbose so that you get more used to the notation. So we want to contract lambda with C. So what we're doing is saying lambda C, right? So this, if you want, takes the C transform into lambda, and that's what we get. So that's one contraction. Out of that, we can obtain the Ricci scalar. And that's R, which is G, AB, RAB. Remember, we didn't have many choices to do the contraction. We couldn't have contracted the first two indices because that's anti-symmetric, and the contraction would have given us zero. We couldn't have contracted the last two indices because those are anti-symmetric. The contraction would give us zero. So the only we can do is just this. We could have also done this and that, the second and the fourth. But because of our symmetries, it would have been the same thing. It doesn't matter. So these are two special contractions. And the R one is to consider a trace-free part. And this is much more. Let's call it C rho oof. Sigma mu nu. Sorry, I'm going back to Greek letters. No, great, I'm going back to the Greek letters.
Okay.
Okay, so this is a trace-free part. So if you take any trace whatsoever or any two indices, you're going to get a zero. This is known as the Bayel tensor. Bayel tensor. It comes in very handy when defining gravitational waves in a rigorous way. It only makes sense if your space dimensions is greater or equal to 3, right? We couldn't put 2, we get a divergence. But we knew we would have that because we already discussed that for n equal 2, we only had one independent component. So there is the trace-free part is 0, doesn't even exist.
So the trace-free part is called the
Bayel tensor. No. So yeah, the trace-free part of the Riemann tensor is a Bayel tensor. It has the same symmetry properties of your Riemann tensor, and it will come very handy, as I said, when discussing waves. Where did that come from? Come from if you want the, your desire or maybe your choice to write your tensor, your basic tensor, in terms of things that have trace and things that have no trace.
Yeah. Where did the terms come from? How did you count
these terms? Oh, good. If you want, then you can say the other way around. I want a tensor C such that it keeps track of the trace-free parts of R. So I start with the R, I put contractions, and start subtracting what is left. And because of that, okay, this we define these constructions, contraction if you want, and this is why these R's here you have the Ricci tensor show up and the Ricci scalar shows up. And another thing that happens is that for n equal to 3, so for n 2 or below, it doesn't, we don't have this definition. For n equal 3, this is exactly 0. And it's also related to the fact that we don't have gravitational waves in 3, in 2 plus 1 dimensions. That's why. This object is interesting. The last promise I had, one extra condition, and that condition is the Bianchi identity. So let me add it here.
G rho mu with the first term on the
here. So let's see. It better be that is anti-symmetric in mu and u, this is giving me that. It better be that it's anti-symmetric in mu and rho, it's giving me that. But oh, here, it should have been sigma. Great, thank you. So the last property, I. Oh, where are we going? So this is Bianchi identity. Yes. Okay, we have 1, 2, 3. Your name, where you're from, what do you like to do?
My name is Dait. I'm from Ethiopia. I like to listen to music.
Cool. You did it already? You did it already. Okay, you. You guys flipped the order of sitting. I'm now confused. Okay.
I'm Saba, and I'm from Iran. And I like to do many things in my free time, but here I climb and I run sometimes.
Cool. All right, we'll go back to you.
Okay. I am Adrian. I am from Venezuela. And what do I do right now? Singing, also a series I love. Yeah, Breaking Bad is amazing.
Oh, cool. All right. Thank you. Okay, so one last thing we can do, and this is going to be, you're going to say, oh, this is great. It's called now a special another tensor. So we have the Riemann, the Ricci, the Ricci scalar, the Ricci tensor, the Riemann tensor, the Bayel tensor. Let's introduce another one, the Einstein tensor. And this is defined this way. And an exercise. Oh, let's call it this way. Or if you want, you can define this way, same thing. Which, again, I have to say, oh, if I have the grad upstairs, have we defined what it is? We haven't. But we haven't, but we know that this is the same as C, G, A, oh, sorry, G. Yeah, AC, right? So if I had the grad here, so this is equal to grad A, GAB. And we do know as well that whenever we have the G, we can always flip. If we have a covariant right here, we can always bring the G inside because the grad of the G is zero, right? The nabla of the G is zero. So where it's inside, where it's outside or inside is in this, it's the same for us. But then this means that this is the same as if I put it inside, and instead of acting on the C to bring up the A, I can act on the A to bring up the C. So this is the same thing as grad C, G, C, B, equal to zero. So whichever version is the same. We can pull indices up and down with our metric. So let's do something useful with this for a change. Let's get our first taste of curvature in something we can relate to. So in Euclidean geometry, one of the kind of the natural consequences was that two parallel curves remain parallel. But we know that's not true if we have a curved spacetime or a curved space. So again, the meridional, what is it? Meridional lines meet at the pole. They start parallel near the equator, but they meet at the pole. So we have two curves there, begin parallel, and just curvature takes them to cross. And of course, that is due to the fact that the space is curved. So let's define or explore geodesic deviation. So let's imagine that we have some geodesics. So we know what the equations of geodesics are for. We can even imagine they are parametrized in the right way so that, let's say, if the geodesics grad dA is a tangent, this is zero. So we've done all our homework to construct that. So we imagine that these are the tangents that are parallel to, now I'm going to call it foliation or a number of geodesics neighboring to each other, which, let's say, we don't know what's going to happen here. So let me just make them fuzzy. But say somewhere here, we are choosing them to be parallel. We have the vectors, they're orthogonal to each other. So let's imagine that we have this vector Ta here. Let's also use our charts to have very nice coordinates in this direction. And let's also use our charts to have very nice coordinates, at least right here in the orthogonal direction. So we start with a vector, let's call it S, that is orthogonal to T, and it's essentially taking us from this geodesic to one that is nearby. These curves are parameterized by gamma, say of tau, or T, or T, might as well. And let's give it a subindex S, just to say, well, we're really picking this one, this one, this one, so we have a sense that there is an S coordinate going along this direction. So we would want to ask it what happens with these geodesics that are next to each other, that begin parallel as we move forward on our space if the space happens to be curved, or allowing for the space to be curved.
Wait, sorry, which one's gamma again?
So gamma is a curve.
Those ones?
That's any gamma of a particular S is one particular curve.
One curve and S is a different curve?
Right, if I choose S1, let's say it would be this one, S2 is that one, S3 is that one, so we just foliate many of them.
Okay.
So we have an infinite number of geodesics, if you want, neighboring geodesics, and we're using this parameter to just parameterize it.
And then the S going across this way?
Yes, at this initial time, let's we pick one, it's going orthogonal to it, and then we're going to try to see what happens as we move forward.
Wait, I'm a little confused.
Yes.
Are we assuming we're like a particle or like a sheet and like looking at like...
If you want, you're imagining many test particles that are falling in their free whatever way due to the curvature, the possible curvature of the space-time as they go. Yeah. If we didn't have anything...
S at all.
Oh, because we're going to try and ask a question. What happens with this S as we move forward? So for instance, this tells us that there is no acceleration tangent to the geodesic. But we could also say, so let's call it, we're going to define vector TA is our tangent vector to the curve. And this is dx mu dt. But then we can also define the SA, which is the deviation vector, which will be dx mu ds. So as we vary in this direction, are the components tangential to the curve varying? So is this curve getting turned around in some ways? And then this way we're introducing this S, a vector that would measure how this thing changes with its nearby geodesic. So if this S gets to be shorter and shorter, then they are about to cross. If it's longer and longer, they are diverging from each other. So we want to see where we can come up with an expression that would measure that. Thanks for the question. So we're going to define the following. Let's see. Suppose, let me start again. So TAB, right, sigma S mu. And let's see what this is. We're parallel transporting S along T. And we want to know is, this would be like a relative velocity. It's how that separation between two nearby geodesics changes along the geodesics as we go forward. But then if to this object, we take another derivative. So this was the relative velocity. Now this thing, so we're taking a second derivative along the flow. So this is like a relative acceleration. This measures the acceleration of nearby geodesics. We know we don't have acceleration along the curve because we're in geodesic. Here we're just talking what happens with the relation between one geodesic and a nearby geodesic. We need to write down what it is because we're saying it's an acceleration. Let's call it A. So, and then I start, if I don't know what it is, okay, rho is taken care of, sigma is taken care of, this has to be a mu. So now what we have to do is work through by using Leibniz. So when this acts on that, I can have the grad acting on T or grad acting on this piece.
Wait, sorry, okay. So can we think of T and then gradient, which is the covariant derivative. Do we think of that as a directional derivative?
Along the curve, exactly.
Because
if you want, this is a general derivative, which is covariant because we have a curve manifold. Uh-huh. But instead of that, pick the components that are along T. So this is the same as having done what you just said. If I have a vector ai dxi, so it's the derivative of f, is the derivative of f along ai. So this is what we're doing.
Taking the, so if inside the parentheses is the relative velocity between.
So here, this is, if you want, it says displacement vector from this geodesic to land in the next geodesic.
Okay.
And so then we're saying this is the first rate of change of that vector.
Oh.
Here is the second, when we act on this one, we'll obtain the second rate of change.
Okay, so it's like the acceleration of s with respect.
Right. So then we act on this, and we're going to have first t rho, grad rho of t sigma, grad sigma of s mu plus t sigma t rho, grad rho, grad sigma of s mu. So here what I use is Leibniz. So act the first, this is a kind of derivative. As you want, directional derivative, directional covariant derivative acting on the first object times the second, plus the directional derivative acting on the second times the first one. And I just arrange things this way. So now we're going to start pulling things up. So I could do this, and one key piece, one key step would be at some point we can take this derivative and flip the order. Mm-hmm. If I flip the order, I pick up an R.
Oh, really?
Because
right.
We did
commutator.
Right. The commutator of covariant derivatives picks up an R. But we're going to do something slightly. First, we're going to do kind of a sleight of hands. We started with S and T being orthogonal to each other, or in coordinate representation. So it would be the case, at least there, that the commutator of S and T, which are two vectors that start being, that are orthogonal to each other, is zero. Which means SA grad A of TB is equal to, or minus TA grad A of SB is zero. So where are we going to use that? So I'm going to use it back here, but from the very beginning. This is what we wanted to compute. By using that relation, I can flip the S and the T. Put an S here and a T.
The derivative isn't from the commutator, right? You just stuck it in and used the commutation relation?
Say again?
That covariant derivative is not.
It's a definition of the commutator.
Oh, it is.
Yes.
Okay.
So I did that. So let me just try and make sure that this one would have been an S, this would have been a T, this would have been an S, and this would have been a T. And it will turn out to be convenient once we try and express the final expression. Okay, so let me leave this aside for a second. Let me just act with the second, this one and the other one, this piece. So first thing first, let's flip the order. So now I have two derivatives here and the Riemann. What do I want to do? I want to rewrite this. Because what, notice where we're going. This T rho, grad sigma, grad rho. If I manage to stick this T in here, what would I get? I get T rho, grad rho of T mu. T was a geodesic. We're going to be able to throw at least that term out. So this is the same as S sigma, grad sigma, T rho, grad rho of T mu, but I have to get rid of the stuff that you just added, which would be the grad sigma of T rho. plus R mu nu rigma rho sigma t nu. So this piece goes away because it's a geodesic. This piece is identically equal to zero.
Wait, is that t? What's the index on the t over there?
Which one?
On the one completely to the right.
Oh, t.
What's that index? Is that a gamma?
Mu.
Oh, that's a.
No. It's t nu.
Nu. Okay. Okay. Sorry. Hold on. I feel like I missed stuff because I was writing this down.
Okay. And I'm missing the S sigma and the T rho.
So what was just like the general picture of how we took it from the before to this?
Here to there?
Yeah. We had that line with a couple of things switched and then.
So here, we were here. So then we just said, flip the rho and the sigma using the commutator. That would create this piece, which is the sigma rho,
uh-huh.
and a Riemann.
Right.
Now, okay, I keep this one on the side, and I work here.
Okay.
I work here, I see a T rho standing in front. And notice, so I have a Riemann. Of course, I know where I'm trying to get to. I have first derivatives here, or products of first derivatives. Here I have a second derivative, which is kind of annoying. Mm-hmm. Like, I want to kind of think that the second derivatives will just stay in Riemanns as far as possible. So can I do something with these second derivatives? So then I notice I can throw this one in. When I throw it in.
What do you mean you can throw?
I mean the following. So T rho grad sigma grad rho of T mu. This is the same as grad sigma T rho. And I'm going to put two parentheses. Grad sigma zero grad rho t mu, right? Minus grad sigma t rho grad rho t mu, right? So I'm re-expressing this as what happens if I pull, if you want, the grad here and act on the whole thing. This is what I'm doing. Minus the piece that I wouldn't be making sense of because it's, I don't have it. So I have, imagine throwing this to the left-hand side. Right?
Oh.
It will change a plus sign,
okay.
And the combination of this and that gives you this.
Yeah.
So I'm using this. And the reason I'm using this is because this one gives me the geodesic equation, T rho, D rho of T mu.
Mm-hmm.
That's zero.
Is that supposed to be a sigma?
Yes, sorry.
Okay.
That's good. Now I have that one. But then this one, combined with the S sigma that was sitting in front, will cancel that.
Okay. So the second line to the third line, are we really adding those up? Or we took that second line and turned it into the third line?
Yeah. So this we're doing here. We're taking this.
Because we switched right. Okay. But then we still have like a second derivative piece
here. It's a product of first derivatives. So that's
that one's product of first derivatives, but we have the covariant derivative with
no, because that one evaluates zero.
But above it, the line above it.
No, this is so. This we turn into that.
Oh, so we're not actually adding these together. That second line.
Oh no, sorry.
Oh.
Yeah. So I'm. I mean, each line has a plus sign, and we're going this way.
Okay. Okay.
My bad. Sorry about that. And so this get thrown out because of geodesic. This combined with that to give us zero. And the end result is that the acceleration is given by and so that's where we arrive to, that even without having used, we have yet to introduce the dynamics prescription. This is purely kinematic. We have a manifold. Manifold has a metric. Associated to the metric, we have a covariant derivative. Associated to that, we can compute the Riemann tensor. And if we ask the question, what happens with two geodesics that are initially parallel, we'll find that there is an acceleration that is determined by the Riemann tensor. So if the Riemann tensor is exactly zero, there is no acceleration, relative acceleration.
Is there some relation like that? The equation up there looks pretty similar to this one, but not quite. Is there?
We're exactly using that one.
The V sigma A mu B nu.
So every time you have two covariant derivatives in a row, you can flip them with the Riemann tensor, or acting on a tensor. If it is more complicated, then there are terms that you need to do. But you can always flip the order of covariant derivatives and pick Riemann tensor.
Okay, okay.
Can you explain which one there? I still don't.
Which one?
This term. No, the next slide.
This one? Let me do it in a different way. Suppose.
No, I don't understand the first term. What
this one?
The first term on the right-hand side, yeah.
Right.
This is the, what is the?
This is the covariant, okay, this is the covariant derivative of the whole thing.
No, but the brackets inside.
Here? I didn't want to put another parenthesis. If you want, I can put this one. But it's just so that to kind of remember where things came from. So I just flip this one here, like turn these two. And so I just try to keep it as an entity so that I was hoping that was going to make it clearer, but obviously it didn't.
Okay. So,
but the only thing I'm doing is it's just this observation, if you want. Let's start with that one, and I'm going to go this way. So this is a covariant derivative of, I'm going to consider this object and this whole object. So this will be, using Leibniz, is the gradient, the covariant derivative of the first object times the second plus the first object, undifferentiated, times the covariant derivative of the second object. So this was just expanding this. And then I notice, when I see here, I see this piece sitting here. And I decide to write this piece as that minus this.
What it's actually telling us is that like the acceleration is equal to the change of S sigma when it be parallel transported along T nu and T rho, something like that.
Exactly. So as we go along T, there will be a neck acceleration that measures the relative acceleration of S or the change of S, even by
so the acceleration is like this second order of change, not the changes.
Well, okay, so we have not yet, I have only mentioned this every now and then without making any explicit calculation, but we're going to do that. In using also our equivalence, all the equivalence principles, we argue that locally, the metric can always be seen as flat. Not only that, first derivatives of the metric can always be rendered to zero. So if you choose a series coordinate. So anything that knows about the curvature will have to have second derivatives. So this was a consequence, or is a consequence, of everything that we're building. And we're going to go a bit before that, and in the last few minutes.
And can we go a little bit again about the interpretation?
Sure.
In the sense of, you mentioned, OK, geodesics that's parallel, curvature is somehow related to the failure for them to remain parallel.
Yes.
And how does that follow from the starting point? In the sense of, before we swapped S and T, it was something like you had a vector field S, you take the derivative, directional derivative along T, and then you take the directional derivative along that, of all of that thing along T.
Right.
How does that relate to the thing about geodesic separating and all of that?
Oh, it's just saying, this at the end of the day, the other acceleration, thanks for the question, that we could always define this acceleration. And we may end up getting, as a result, identically zero. So we'll say that in Euclidean geometry, the Riemann tensor will be identically zero. And so this will give us zero, and they will say the acceleration, the relative acceleration between the two geodesics would stay zero, and so
yeah.
They will not change. So if you want use Newton's laws, there is no acceleration.
Yeah. But maybe my question would be, why can we associate this with acceleration of geodesics. That would be maybe why that expression particularly has that physical or geometric
interpretation. Sure. So I started, this is a vector that is orthogonal to my geodesic.
Okay.
And I want to ask, does that vector change as I move along the geodesic? So the first rate of change is the velocity. The second rate of change is the acceleration. So that's what it said.
Okay, so the acceleration of that vector along the geodesic.
The acceleration of the orthogonal vector along the geodesic.
And we didn't impose orthogonality, really, but we imposed commutativity.
Well, it's in here because we said, okay, we can choose these bases so that these two things are orthogonal to each other and they go this way. So this relation stays.
So why are we using... I also don't have a good geometrical interpretation of the commutator between two vectors or two vector fields. How is that related to orthogonality or to... Is there any geometrical interpretation like that?
Think about that. So one thing is we want them orthogonal as well because this, you could have another change that is associated to how rapid the vector is changing along the geodesic. So we wouldn't want that to kind of affect the result. So we have something that's orthogonal.
Okay.
And what else is?
It's just like you're parallel transporting once SB along TA, and then you're parallel transporting TB along SA.
Right, but they are saying that whatever change, they are exactly the same. And they have to be exactly the same to maintain their orthogonality.
On that interpretation,
yes.
The geometric interpretation of the commutator vanishing, I don't see why if they're orthogonal, the parallel transports of the parallel transport of T along S have to be identical to the parallel transport of S along T.
Right. So that has to do because we are choosing in the Rn the representation of each vector such that that is true. So that was our choice. But I mean, I am fully aware that I'm not giving you a very nice answer. Let me take a rain check of that and I'll try to expand on this. But in the last few minutes, let me just make contact to just see an explicit expression. So let's take the simplest possible case, n equal 2. Our metric, let's say we're computing distances in our metric, and let's imagine that we have a sphere of radius a. So metric distances in that sphere, on that sphere, will be given by the following choice, or the following line element. And let me make a point here. This is a choice. I have just introduced, say, if you want, a chart, as we said at the very beginning, actually two charts, because we cannot do that with a single one. I mean, we have a coordinate singularity at the pole, so we would choose one chart, or let's say the northern hemisphere, another one with the southern hemisphere. But at this point, it's a midpoint. I'm just stressing that. We could have chosen other coordinates. We could have chosen a stereographic projection of the sphere, and then this would have looked different. But this is just a fact of life. We don't have a unique set of coordinate systems. We might have different representations. So we have just chosen this for familiarity. Let's say our line element, which is how we define this ds square notation to be, is given by that. So the next thing, so how do we work with this? Well, to construct the Riemann, so first we construct the Christoffel. And this is a very simple expression, or very simple calculation. So I'm just going to give you the non-trivial, or the component of the Christoffels that are non-zero, even though the metric is so symmetric and simple, you don't get much left here. So it's so these are the only non-trivial Christoffel symbols that you get. So as an exercise, get that metric, use our definition of the Christoffel symbols that is somewhere over there, and then compute it. Of course, often when you see in the literature components given, the symmetries are assumed. So if I say these are the only non-trivial components, it's understood that these, of course, is also non-zero, right? Even though I'm not giving it to you, you just are implying that any non-trivial value associated with a symmetry is also included. So these are our two, or if you want, our three non-trivial components. So in particular, gamma phi theta theta is equal to 0. Gamma phi 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 is also equal to 0. So now you can use the definition of our Riemann tensor, which is somewhere over there. So you can use the gammas, act on that. Your coordinates are 2, theta and phi, to obtain the following. R, remember how many independent components of the Riemann tensor we would get in this case? Just one, right? Because we did the calculation and it was somewhere there, this n square, whatever, remember it was 112 n square times n square minus 1.
You just have two, is it, it's like two dimensions?
Yes.
N equals 2, okay.
So if you go through the calculation, you'll find out that you have r theta, phi theta phi is equal to sine squared theta, which then says if you can bring the index down, you can flip things, but this is the only component that is non-trivial. So in particular, you could also say the following. Using the fact that the metric, let's say GAB, is a square sine square theta, theta 0, 0. GAB is 1 over a square, 0, 0, 1 over a square sine square theta. Remember, it has to be the case that GAB, GBC is delta BC, which is the identity matrix. So out of this one, you can compute the Ricci tensor. And what you have is r theta is equal to 1, r theta phi is equal to 0, r phi is equal to sine squared theta.
Is there any chance you won't make us do a non-trivial like Riemann tensor for our homework?
Is there any? No, you will have to. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah, part of the.
Can we use like Maple?
Of course. Oh. No, absolutely. I mean, you can use whatever you want. And Maple is pretty good. Mathematics is pretty good.
Okay.
Make sure you understand what you're doing. Double check. But sure. I mean, but yeah, there is some suffering in GR. We need to. So the first thing, so this is a Riemann tensor. These are the components of the Riemann tensor. Remember, Riemann tensor, we're in two dimensions. We only have one free component. And so it's not surprising that the Riemann tensor, if you just read the components, are exactly like the metric. So we have RAB is 1 over a square GAB, if I manipulate that. But that's okay. We know we have only one piece of free information. This is a 2 tensor, 0, 2 tensor, which is completely symmetric. And we also know of another tensor that is 0, 2 tensor that is completely symmetric, which is symmetric. So it's not surprising that you end up in this case with RAB proportional to GAB. And time and again, we might encounter this. In very special situations that are highly symmetric, we're going to say, oh, because of the properties of the object we're working with, if we want to express it in different ways, we're going to find that indeed we can connect with our special objects in our system. If you want as well, the Riemann tensor, remember the Riemann tensor, we said their components are trace-free and full trace parts. This is just saying the Riemann tensor can be written essentially through the Ricci scalar or the Ricci tensor. So it's just also to express that we only have one degree of freedom, one non-trivial piece of information in the Riemann. Yes.
So we have one degree of freedom that is free in this case.
Yes.
But you said you mapped the, and then you expressed that using the 1 over A, but then you mapped the Ricci tensor to the metric and not, say, the identity matrix.
Sorry, say that again?
Over there, when you're sort of heuristically trying to derive the form of the Ricci tensor, you said, I have one degree of freedom, one free degree of freedom, and you expressed that in the 1 over A squared.
Yes.
But then the tensor part, you mapped it to the metric tensor, not the identity tensor, for example, or some other two tensor.
You're saying, why then did I choose the metric and not the identity?
Some other two-index object.
Because I also need to know, so the Riemann is also telling me about this, the manifold, the particular manifold I'm in. And then the only object that one object that we know knows about the manifold is the metric. So if I put the identity metric, well, I lose that connection. But actually, that's a pretty cool question. I never thought about this one. Finally, you can compute the Ricci scalar. And the Ricci scalar is given by this. And we encounter something. So just telling us the Ricci scalar, the Ricci curvature, goes inversely proportional to the radius. So the smaller the radius of our sphere, the higher the curvature is going to be. And that's okay. If you traverse a little bit, you can imagine how much the tensor is changing in a small sphere or an infinitely large sphere. So if you take this sphere infinitely large, r is going to zero. So you see less and less of the curvature for any little change. So let me see what else it was.
Something regarding David's question. Like, you don't put Ricci tensor equal to something, right? You should calculate all these various things.
Of course. No, in general, I'm saying do this. What I'm saying is that, okay, now we've got a result. Does it make sense? Can we find it natural? And the answer is yes, we can find it natural. So this is only in very special situations you can do that. So we're going to stop here. So now, okay, you can pat yourself in the back. You live through this kind of terse differential geometry. We're going to start putting it to good use next week. We're going to derive Einstein equations. When we do so, remember we introduced the Einstein tensor. Well, we'll come out very handy, because it is the one that makes sense to try and make a connection with Newtonian theory, and you'll see why. We're going to discuss a few cases, and maybe we're going to go to black holes. And along the way, I'm going to start bringing things that are part of differential geometry, but I didn't want to just overwhelm you with things. In particular, we define the covariant derivative. I mentioned there were two other derivatives. Also, when acting on a vector, gives you a bona fide tensor at the end. We haven't gone there, but it will show up. Another thing will be, given a metric, how do we understand where our space M is symmetric? I just threw that word a few minutes ago, that because our space is sufficiently or highly symmetric, we end up with a structure. It's very simple, and the Christoffels and the structures that we get out of it. We will want to know what the right structure we need to introduce or explore to find out where our space-time has particular symmetries, and that will take us into another discussion. But I'd rather start bringing those in as we need them to do physics. With this, I think we have enough of a background to start moving forward and make the connection with the true ingredients of the theory and the consequences. The last thing I'm going to say is that, incidentally, this acceleration of nearby geodesics is essentially what gravitational wave detectors are after. Right? You have a detector, and you send some laser to a mirror, and then you're trying to see if this is accelerating any time with respect to some central notion of whether there is a variation or not. And so this is, eventually you can get contact with gravitational waves out of this equation.
Sorry, dragging things on. But okay, so this acceleration, right, it seems like it only has one derivative. When you have the Riemann tensor.
One derivative? Why one derivative?
It's in the Riemann tensor has the derivatives, but then it.
Oh, no, it has two, because remember there is a Christoffel. And
the Christoffel is a bunch of G's, but there's no derivative.
No, the Christoffel. Okay, great question. Thank you.
Oh, you're right, there are commas. Ah.
No, hold on. So.
Yeah.
The Christoffel. Yeah, so these are the common.
Yeah, okay.
So they have the first derivative there, which would enter there through a second derivative and then we'll go through. But we're going to do a couple of very specific examples where you see how it goes through and how we connect with Newtonian gravity.
Okay. Oh, that's cool.
I'm still confused. So the last two terms on the Riemann tensor would become zero here?
The last two terms are? There is a symmetry. Careful. We have to be very careful with the symmetries. We have nu and rho.
Yeah.
So these are not at the anti-symmetric. If we had, for instance, nu and sigma, that will give us a zero. The anti-symmetric. Yeah. So here we don't have that, right? The signs, the indices are such that they contract. They have to be. So nu and sigma are anti-symmetric.
I kind of feel like the indices are wrong a little bit.
I should have.
Oh yeah.
Thank you.
And so. Okay.